From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
Designers, you have 30 minutes.
Today, Tim Gunn of Project Runway and the new fashion design competition Under the Gun. Gunn is the former chair of fashion design at Parsons.
And I have to say, there is no population that is worse dressed than academics. They are horrible. I actually work with people who wore pajamas with soccer balls on them and elephants.
Gunn is famous as a mentor, but he had a tough adolescence. He stuttered, was in denial about being gay, and was bullied. After Gunn tried to kill himself at age 17, his father took him to the hospital.
What I didn't expect was that I'd spend the next 2.5 years there.
We're in the hospital?
Mm-hmm. It was a psychiatric hospital for adolescents. It saved my life.
Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews two novels she says are antidotes to the winter blues. First news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We know from Project Runway that my guest Tim Gunn is very serious about the design of clothing, but he can also be really funny talking about fashion. He's become famous as a mentor to designers, but his personal story has inspired people too. He's offered his experiences as an example of how you can turn your life around after being in such despair you tried to end it, which is what he tried to do when he was 17. On Project Runway, Gunn was the mentor to the fashion designers in the competition. On his new Lifetime reality series, Project Runway Under the Gun, three Project Runway alumni each have a team of designers to mentor. Each week, a designer is sent home by the judges. The final designer left in the competition and that designer's mentor will be the winners. Tim Gunn had an academic career before television made him famous. He's the former chair of the fashion design department at Parsons, the New School for Design. I spoke with Tim Gunn about clothing and his life. Tim Gunn, welcome to Fresh Air. It is a pleasure to have you on the show. So you say that, you know, what you wear sends a message to people, whether you know it or not, whether you're thinking about it or not. You're on the radio, so people cannot see what you're wearing. In fact, I cannot see what you're wearing because you're in a studio in New York and I'm at a studio in Philadelphia. Would you tell us, please, what you are wearing?
And you know, Terry, this is what I love about radio. I mean, I have a whole series of meetings today. I've come from some. I'm going off to others. I'm wearing a suit and a shirt and a tie, and I'm wearing boots that are not fashion boots. They're winter weather boots because there's slush and snow out there. So I have to say, though, I am an individual who is always aware of how he's presenting himself. And I certainly developed that awareness when I was teaching because I'm a role model in a manner of speaking for my students. And I have to say, there is no population that is worse dressed than academics. They are horrible. I actually work with people who, they weren't my faculty. When I was chairing the fashion department, I had, I won't say rules, but there were certainly expectations. But when I was in a larger academic community, I actually knew of fellow faculty members who wore pajamas. I mean, literally pajamas with soccer balls on them and elephants and you name it. I thought, this is horrifying. Horrifying. What is this? What message does this send to your students?
So what message are you sending by, when we see you on television anyways, you're wearing a suit, a very fine suit. By fine, I don't necessarily mean expensive, but like well-fitting.
And it's not.
Handsome.
Well, thank you. I mean, I will share with you that I really believe in shopping on a budget, and I don't believe for a moment that that compromises how good you can look. And this company has a name that I find somewhat regrettable because it's not a sexy name, but it's a company out of the Netherlands called Suit Supply, one word, and it's all menswear. It's very stylish and it's very affordable. So that's important to me. And the message I'm sending is that I have respect for myself. I have respect for you. I'm taking the world seriously, and let's navigate the world with some style.
So I'll tell you what I'm wearing.
I'd love to hear what you're wearing. I'm sure it's not pajamas with soccer balls.
It's not pajamas with soccer balls. That's the good news. The bad news is what I'm wearing is black corduroy jeans with a gray zip-up fake leather jacket and a black sweater underneath it and then a scarf because I get cold easily. But I wanted to ask you about this. The jacket I'm wearing, it's like fake leather. I like leather a lot. I know you're not into using fur out of respect to animals. I don't know how you feel about leather.
I've altered my position. I used to say that until the leather gets the fake leather becomes more believable, I wouldn't consider it. It's very believable these days. I would wear fake leather in a heartbeat.
Whew, okay.
Yeah, in fact, you sound as though you look very chic.
Oh, good. Okay. So here's my other question about the jacket I'm wearing. You know, there's something that's called pleather. It's kind of like, what does that stand for? Polyester leather or something?
It's a speedier way of saying faux leather.
Right. It's like fake leather. So, and pleather just always sounded so like fake. But now I see ads for vegan leather. And vegan leather, it sounds so righteous. It's like, I am such a good person. I refuse to harm animals with leather. So the garment I am wearing is a righteous garment. It's not fake anything. It stands for my principles. It's vegan leather. And I thought, like, wow, what incredible branding to go from, like, it's fake to, like, it's so righteous.
But you know what it makes me think?
What?
The term vegan leather makes me think that you peeled a carrot and took the skin and made a jacket out of it.
Yum.
How about it?
So in one of your books, you tell what I think is a really hysterical story about going to Woodstock dressed entirely inappropriately for the occasion. Describe to us what you wore to Woodstock.
Oh, I was wearing gray flannel pants and Weejuns and a
Weejuns, for people who don't know, these very, like, preppy sandals. I don't mean sandals. I mean
loafers.
Loafers. Yeah. Yes. Thank you.
And a classic blue blazer with brass buttons. Hey, you know, Terry, what happened to the Weejun? Why hasn't that come back?
I don't know. There were two kinds. There was the kind with the tassel and then the penny loafer version.
The penny loafer was the one I preferred. Mm-hmm. But that was a great classic style. It should return.
Mm-hmm. In oxblood.
At any rate, that's
yes.
how I arrived dressed at Woodstock, only to sink up to my calves in mud.
So did you feel like you were dressed wrong, or that, like, all the other thousands of people who were there who were somewhere wearing something between, like, bell bottoms and nothing were wrong?
That's very true. I felt as though my little school group and I had landed on another planet. And I had never, well, certainly hadn't experienced anything like it, hadn't seen anything quite like it, and could never have anticipated it. And I couldn't get out of there quickly enough, to be perfectly honest. But upon reflection, I'm so thrilled to have had that experience, because what a moment in our cultural history Woodstock was. I mean, phenomenal.
Did you go home and then trade in your flannel pants for bell bottoms?
Oh, no, no. And that was a school uniform, so I couldn't have done anything about it anyway.
So you went in your school uniform?
We all did. I mean, that's what we wore.
That's great. How did you feel about having to wear a uniform in general?
Well, you know, at the time, I found it to be very restricting, and I felt something like a prisoner. But I have recalibrated thinking about the uniform. I find it's very democratizing. You don't have to get up in the morning and think about, what am I going to wear? And for girls in particular, I love a uniform, because the fashion pressures on teenagers and younger women are extraordinary. And living in New York City, I love the private schools that have a uniform. And I have to say, I have something of a disdain for those that don't, because the fashion competition is ridiculously stupid. In fact, it's absurd. I live in an apartment building with a lot of teenage girls who go to private schools, and I'm always supporting the ones in the uniforms. And I hear the other ones talking about how, this is marked by Marc Jacobs and not Marc Jacobs. And I want to say, cry me a river, you little 13-year-old. I mean, what is this? It's a crazy, crazy world out there, and crazier for some than others.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Tim Gunn. And, of course, he is the head mentor of Project Runway. Now there's a new series on Lifetime called Project Runway Under the Gun, in which he mentors the mentors, and the mentors mentor the fashion designers. Let's take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Tim Gunn, who is famous for Project Runway, and now he has a new series on Lifetime, which is called Project Runway Under the Gun, in which he mentors the fashion mentors who mentor the designers. And the designers compete with themselves, and the mentors compete with themselves. Tim Gunn, you always look so poised and centered when we see you on TV. But you've suffered and you've spoken about that. You've written about it, and you also did a video for the It Gets Better project about telling people who've been bullied because they're gay that, you know, hold on, it gets better. And in your It Gets Better video, you talked about how you tried to overdose on pills when you were 17. And I was wondering, like, had something happened right before that that set you across the line into suicide?
Well, yes, something did happen. I had been dropped off at yet another boarding school by my parents. I can't even recite the number of schools that I went to as a kid because I was constantly running away from them. I mean, it's so ironic that I would become a career educator because I hated school so profoundly. And it wasn't the learning experience that I hated. I hated the social aspects. So I'd been dropped off at yet another boarding school. And it was that first night. I had taken, I don't even know how many prescription medications out of my parents' medicine chest. And I didn't even know what they were. I mean, I knew they were prescription, but I didn't know what they were. And I took all of them, probably easily 100 pills. And I was so resigned to just going to sleep and not waking up. And that next morning, I did wake up. And I was completely disoriented. The room was spinning. I couldn't believe I was still alive. And that morning, I ran away. And I found a little hiding place, and I hid out for hours. And my disorientation didn't get better. So I went to the school administrators and told them what I had done. And then, of course, they brought in a doctor. And in spite of the fact that I was still there, they took my blood, pumped my stomach. There was still stuff in it. Anyway, it's a long-winded way of saying, yes, there was a catalyst. It was that I was being dropped off at yet another school. I had no reason to believe that that experience was going to be any better than anything else that I had gone through. And I thought, I don't like this life. This is really rotten. And I want to just stop it.
Why had you been to so many boarding schools? Was it you who wanted to leave, or were you thrown out?
Oh, no, I wasn't thrown out. I mean, I was a diligent student, and I wasn't a troublemaker. I was constantly running away. I hated interacting with people. Also, I should add, and actually some of it you can hear now, I had a very debilitating stutter. And that was very limiting for me socially. And it, of course, was rife for teasing. And people would imitate me, or they'd want to engage with me, would want me to speak, because they wanted to hear the stutter and laugh. So that exacerbated everything that I experienced, and it added a painful dimension to every kind of interaction, whether it was with peers or whether it was with doctors.
Did you know then that you were gay, and did that contribute to your depression and your thought that you wanted to end it?
You know, I won't say that I knew I was gay. I knew what I wasn't. And I certainly wasn't attractive to girls, but I didn't know what I was. I called myself non-sexual at that young an age. I did. I mean, it was like, I don't have a sexual bone in my body. There was zero attraction in any direction, or either direction, I should say. Well, no, I'll say any. It doesn't just have to be men or women. It could be anything.
Did you feel like there was something wrong with you because you didn't feel sexual?
Well, at the time, I was on a sort of moral high horse, and I, in some ways, associated myself with the clergy, even though I wasn't a religious person. And I thought, this is all perfectly acceptable. I didn't think of it as being something wrong. It may have been unusual, but then I was an odd kid. I mean, I wasn't a sports person, though I was a very good competitive swimmer. In fact, I held a couple of New England records for a while. And I love swimming because, as I still say about it, it's clean and you don't sweat. and it's a solitary sport. I mean, there are relays where you're swimming with other people, but it's something you can do alone, like running, but it's not cleaning. You do sweat. And I, you know, I actually begged my parents for piano lessons, and I ended up studying the classical piano for 12 years. I mean, I was just, and I would rather be in my room alone with my Legos and my books than play with people.
You know, you had told us about that funny story about dressing in your school uniform at Woodstock. Was that before or after the suicide attempt? And which school was it? Was that the school that you had just arrived at?
Oh, no. No. Because the suicide attempt school, I was there for a day and a half.
And then you left.
By the time I got back to the headmaster's home, actually, and wept and confessed everything, they already knew. They found the pills in a trash can, or they found the pill containers. They had already had a doctor on call. And my father had already come up from Washington. So I arrived in his house, and my father was there. So, and my father took me to the hospital. And what I didn't expect was that I'd spend the next 2.5 years there.
We're in the hospital?
Mm-hmm. Yes. I don't know that I've said that to anyone.
Wow.
I mean, more precisely, 2 years and 4 months. So I had a very major intervention there and couldn't run away, or I would have.
Was that considered like rehab? Was it like a rehab setting?
It was a psychiatric hospital for adolescents.
Was it the right thing to do, you think?
Yes. It saved my life. The doctor I had there... And he was actually my third doctor because I was a very difficult patient. And doctors would, I won't say give up on me, but they'd pass after about 3 months. And Dr. Philip Goldblatt, God bless him, of New Haven, Connecticut, wouldn't let go. And I saw him 5 days a week for almost 2 years.
What made doctors give up on you before that, do you think?
They would lose patience. I will say this about myself. I'm smart and I'm canny. I figure things out quickly, and I knew how to manipulate and maneuver around them, and I knew how to simply be intractable and difficult. And for Dr. Goldblatt, I mean, our first couple of months together, he was with me almost all day, every day. And it was a matter of, guess what? You can't escape me. And if you want to keep playing these games, I'm here to say, okay, play them. I'm going to watch it all happen. But I'm not leaving. And I didn't believe him. And I tried to push all of his buttons so that he would reject me. And he wouldn't stand for it. And I love that man. In fact, I tear up when I think about him and what he did for me.
Do you think about him when you're mentoring people?
I do.
Did sexual orientation come up in your many sessions with him? Was that something you could confide in him?
You know, it came up later because I would have, after having had this intense relationship with him and then being discharged, I would have an occasional booster shot with him where I would make an appointment and return to see him. And one of those was when I accepted my sexual orientation, and I went to Sam, and I just said, I want to share this with you. And we talked it through, and we agreed that I'd been in denial for a long time, and this couldn't allow this to come to the surface. And it was an epiphany for me to be able to acknowledge it and to be able to accept it and not feel hateful about it.
Do you have a sense of why you... Tell me if I'm pushing too hard on any of this.
No.
Okay. Do you have a sense of, like, why you couldn't accept it for a long time?
Well, when I think about the era, it's the 1960s, late 1960s, going into the early 70s, and it was considered to be something that you fixed. I mean, this was an adolescent psychiatric hospital, so people were teens into early 20s. And there were some people there who were there to have their gayness fixed. So for me, it was like, oh, well, this is something that it's treating a disease. You have to do something about it.
Did you fear that if you said anything about thinking that you were that somebody would try to fix you at the hospital?
Well, I remember thinking, I have enough issues without adding this to the list. Uh-huh. Yeah, I mean, I thought, oh, God. But for the grace of God, there go I. And also, on the one hand, I'm not envious of any young person who's going through a struggle with their sexual identity. I'm not envious at all. On the other hand, there's so many more and more positive role models these days. I mean, when I was a kid, who were the gay people? They're the decorators in the Doris Day movies. They're the fashion designers. They're flitting about. I mean, I think about Paul Lynde on Bewitched. I mean, he was a caricature. And today, we recognize that every flavor of humanity comes in every possible size and color and shape. And we have so much more awareness of the diversity of everyone. I mean, whenever anyone tries to stereotype gay men, it's like, wait a minute. There's just as many who live like slobs.
Tim Gunn will be back in the second half of the show. His new fashion competition on Lifetime is called Project Runway Under the Gun. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Netflix with Season 2 of House of Cards, starring Kevin Spacey, Robin Wright, and Kate Mara. All episodes premiere on Friday, February 14th on Netflix. From Progressive Insurance, with more than 30,000 local independent agents, information available at progressive.com. And from Sit for Life and Herman Miller, featuring the Aeron Chair, including the True Black Color. Sit for Less is now sitforlife.com. This is NPR.
Coming up, Tim Gunn tells us about his parents. His mother was critical of the way he dressed even after he became a famous fashion consultant. His father was an FBI agent and J. Edgar Hoover's ghostwriter. Gunn will also explain why he chooses to live alone. And Maureen Corrigan reviews two books she says are perfect for curling up with on a winter's night. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Tim Gunn. After a long academic career in design, he became famous as a fashion mentor on the fashion design competition Project Runway. He has a new series on Lifetime called Project Runway Under the Gun, which is a competition between fashion designers as well as a competition between their mentors.
Your father, I was so surprised to read this. Your father was an FBI agent, and he became,
yes,
under J. Edgar Hoover, and he became Hoover's ghostwriter.
Yes.
What did he write for Hoover?
He wrote all of his correspondence, all of his speeches, and his books.
Was your father a very macho kind of guy?
Yes. Yeah. He was, had a beer in his hand, watching football every Sunday.
Your father must have had some clue that you were gay. Did...
Oh, absolutely. He certainly knew. I mean, I wasn't throwing the football around. I wasn't interested in the sports. I'm going to choke up again. He was an incredible man. In spite of all the trouble that I gave him and the disdain that I so frequently felt for him, first of all, he was always there in a crisis. Who was there after the suicide attempt? He was. My mother wasn't, because she would fall apart. But also, the whole sports thing, he became the Little League coach because he wanted to support me and wanted me to be playing Little League. Ha! That wasn't going to happen. But when I took to swimming, he became the swim coach. And it was just such a wonderful thing because he was there at every practice. So in many ways, he was really extraordinary. But the one curious matter that I have, also upon reflection, I was the kid who came home from school bloody and bruised with so much frequency. At the time I called, I didn't even use the word bullying then, but just teased and beaten up. I was evidently fun to beat up, as I was just so easy to do it. You know what? My macho father never once took me inside and said, "Let me show you how to fight back. Let me show you how to throw a punch." Never once, and I find it really curious, at least that I can recall. And consequently, if you have a physical fight with me, I'm a biter and a hair puller.
You never came out to either of your parents, right?
No, I certainly did not. What purpose would it have served, to be perfectly honest? My mother certainly figured it out when she stopped trying to matchmake me with the daughters of her friends. My sister knows. We had a heart-to-heart, and she was nothing if not supportive. When all the Project Runway stuff happened, who knew it would become a phenomenon? I thought it was just going to be a little blip, and I was initially just a consultant to the show. I wasn't intended to be on it. But when press started happening and Mother would read everything, she certainly knew. And the fact that she didn't choose to speak about it meant that I didn't need to speak about it. It wasn't as though we had an unresolved issue. It's part of who I am. Though she did say to me when Project Runway was about to start, and actually when I told her that I was going to have this role on the show as a mentor, she said, "Are they crazy? You're so old." So she asked two things of me. She asked me to dye my hair, and she asked me to lie about my birth date. Well, I'm not going to lie. I'm not going to dye my hair. And what purpose would lying about my birth date do? She said, finally, she had said, because she was really begging me to make myself younger than I am. She said, it turned out that she'd been lying about my age.
Oh,
how do you like that?
To who? Oh, maybe because she was lying about her age.
Yes.
So it was all about her.
Exactly.
So when you say, like, what would it have done to come out, I mean, what it would have done was allow you to live in a completely more honest, not completely necessarily, but in a more honest way of like we know I'm gay, but so let's just like acknowledge it. So it's not this kind of thing that we can't ever talk about. Like it doesn't really exist.
But let me also share the juncture where I was, because I had already been through a fairly long and intense relationship that was over. And painfully over. I don't recall ever feeling as hurt, ever. And it was 1982. So it was the advent of AIDS. The person with whom I'd been for so long revealed to me that he'd been sleeping with just about anything and everything in Washington, D.C. I thought, not only have you delivered the largest dote of emotional pain I've ever experienced, but I may also have a death sentence now. So I moved to New York, and quite frankly, he was part of the reason why I accepted the position at Parsons, because we had been together when Parsons had asked me the year before to come and join them, and I said, no, thank you, I'm very happy. But a lot happened in that following year. I moved to New York. I mean, AIDS devastated this nation in the 1980s, and so many young people are so unaware of that. They think, oh, it's HIV, we'll all survive. Well, we didn't. And I was tested for HIV every year, and sometimes more frequently, for years. So I certainly wasn't with anyone. I had no desire to be with anyone. And I found out that I really like myself, and I actually like being alone. So I wasn't going to go into a relationship either. So this is a long-winded way of saying I wasn't going to bring somebody home to my mother to say, guess what? This is my love interest. We're going to be together, or whatever it may be. So that's why I say there was no purpose. And I wasn't altering or amending in any way, shape, or form how I navigated the world or how I interacted with people. I wasn't pretending with my mother to not be gay, but in our household, we didn't talk about sex ever. I mean, of any kind. We didn't engage in that kind of dialogue. So it wasn't as though I was obfuscating or misrepresenting or, God forfend, lying.
Do you think that relationship that you were afraid was not only going to hurt you emotionally but maybe kill you has, like, affected your view of relationships in the more long term?
For me personally, most definitely. Do I project it onto other people? No, except to generally agree that men are rats.
When you said that, you know, after that relationship, you learned that you like being alone. Was it surprising to you that, like, you liked being alone and that you liked yourself, that you could be comfortable with yourself alone?
Oh, it was a fantastic, fantastic moment, I have to say, because so many people have this fear, myself included, about, oh, you know, you can't be alone, and there has to be somebody else, and what are you going to do at night, and there's no one to talk to, and what do you do on the weekends? Well, you enjoy your own company. And it's very, very liberating, and it makes you feel truly independent. And at this point in my life, the only way I could imagine living with someone else would be if we, in fact, had separate rooms and came together, separate bedrooms, came together for conversation and meals, and it would be much more social. But I'll be perfectly candid. Do I have physical needs? Yes. Do I need them to be satisfied by another person? No.
There's more of my interview with Tim Gunn after we take a short break. His new fashion competition, Project Runway Under the Gun, is on Lifetime. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Tim Gunn, who everybody knows from Project Runway and now his new show, Project Runway Under the Gun. You know, there's a very emotional moment on Project Runway where one of the designers explained that he had this secret that he was going to reveal that he was HIV positive. And the designers had been given the task of coming up with a design for fabric that connected to something very personal in their life. And so he had these, like, black pluses, like positive black pluses on this, like, bright purple background. And it was, like, this really beautiful, vivid design. And then he explained...
I remember this profoundly.
Yeah, yes, and then he explained why the pluses, why the positives were there. Did you have a long talk with him after that?
I remember giving him a huge hug and We both shared some tears, and I remember telling him how proud I am. And I felt that that was adequate.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, for him, that was his own way of coming out, because his family didn't know.
Oh, really? Oh.
Yes.
You know, it was in that season. It was in that season that you say, we have a surprise guest for everybody. And everybody's thinking it's going to be a big celebrity. And you open the door, and in walks everybody's mother.
Yes.
And everybody's like in tears. All these designers, all these young designers in tears. Oh, my mother, it's so great to see her. I felt so like lost without her. And I was thinking, if somebody opened the door when you were that age and said, guess what? It's your mother. like you probably would have had a really different reaction.
I probably would have. And my mother would have proceeded. Well, my mother would have probably asked, what are you doing on a fashion design competition? What is this? What's going on? You know, I have to tell you, even having ascended, I'll use that word, having ascended to the position of chair of the fashion design department, having become the mentor in Project Runway, my mother was still so critical of what I would wear. She would be critical of what I would wear on the show. In fact, she would call afterwards and say, why did they let you wear such and such? And that tie didn't look good with that shirt. And then I remember so profoundly going to her home, I'll call it, for Thanksgiving, and walking through the front door, and she looked me up and down, and she said, studying me, with little squinty eyes, she looked at me and she said, why can't you dress more like Mitt Romney? Well, you can imagine my reaction.
What kind of clothes did she wear?
Well, again, God bless her. She was infirm, in her mid-80s. So whatever was comfortable.
But when she was younger.
Oh, she was quite chic and stylish.
Was she?
She was. And my grandmother was quite the fashion plate. In fact, you never saw my grandmother without a hat, ever.
Was it the kind of hats with veils on them? Or
no.
So I remember when that was popular, yeah.
No, they were very chic, very stylish hats.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a great aunt who was petite, and couldn't find anything in stores that really fit her very well, that she liked. She had all of her clothes made, and they all had a label, custom made for Virginia Jones, though she was Aunt Si, S-I. How that happened, I don't know.
So maybe you got some of your fashion sense from your mother.
Well, she was stylish.
In spite of how she would berate you.
Yes, exactly. She was stylish, and she unlike a lot of women of that time, she worked. She was a real estate broker for 30 years. But before that, before she actually gave birth to me, she began the library at the CIA. So library science was really her area.
Wow.
It was interesting. Yeah.
Oh, that's
so it was when the CIA was just beginning.
Wow. So we've talked, you know, about your life and about clothes. You wear suits usually when you're on television and going to meetings and stuff like that. When you're spending basically time at home and you know no one's likely to be visiting on that day and you're not going out, at least not for a while, what do you wear? Do you wear clothes as if somebody would see you, or do you just... Do you have like sweatpants and a sweatshirt that you
actually
wear at times
I don't
like that?
Own either. Mm-hmm. But I mean, at home, in winter weather, I'll wear jeans and a turtleneck. And if it's when the weather's warmer, khakis and just a shirt without a tie or even a t-shirt. So, yeah, I have to tell you, this reminds me of a question I asked Dolly Parton when I was lucky enough to interview her. I told her that I had read that when she and her husband go camping, she's without hair and makeup. And it's just that Dolly, and people probably wouldn't even recognize her. And she said to me, are you kidding? She said, I go to sleep in full hair and makeup. And I asked her why. She said, what if there's a fire? I don't want to disappoint the firemen. Isn't that great?
That is great. But you don't feel that way about yourself.
No. I mean, I'm not. I mean,
someone comes to the door. You're not designed in the way Dolly Parton is. And
no.
You don't have the full hair and makeup thing. It's just like really put together suits.
Yeah. I mean, and Terry, I have to tell you, there's not a single day I don't thank my lucky stars that I'm a guy.
Yeah, tell me why. Because I'll tell you, just speaking for myself, it is so getting nice clothes is such a frustrating experience. So many of the fashions, I think, are just like really hideous or totally inappropriate for me. And I'm really short, so that's a problem too. So clothing, you know, I think clothes are great. If only I could find ones that fit, you know. But tell me your frustration.
Well, I mean, I'm not frustrated. But,
right, because you're a guy, right.
Yeah, but because for guys it's so much easier. The clothing options are fewer. The grooming options are not insurmountable. I never think about doing anything cosmetically altering, as in Botox or fillers or, God forfend, cosmetic surgery.
Thank you.
I don't have to worry. I don't think about dyeing my hair. That's not going to happen. I just am who I am. And for women, there's so many more pressures. And I feel lucky to be the gender that I am.
Just one more thing I just want to say. Because you come off as so like totally poised on TV and so totally together both visually and emotionally, I really appreciate that you're willing to talk about the times in your life when you didn't feel together and how you kind of came out, you know, the other end of that. I think it's really important to hear. So thank you.
Well, thank you for letting me talk about it. May I add one thing on that topic, though?
Because please.
I want anyone listening in hearing the story about my troubled adolescence, I hope it was clear that I didn't come out of this alone. I mean, life is a big collaboration, and when you're tackling something that's painful and troubling and is causing you such desperate grief that you think life's not worth living, you need to reach out. Well, reach out before then, actually, to reach out to people whom you trust, people who will reach back and offer you some solace and some guidance, because it doesn't happen alone. And if I had been just left on my own, well, I wouldn't be here. I simply wouldn't be. And I'm glad I'm here. And there's not a single day I don't thank my lucky stars and say I'm the luckiest guy alive. And I will also say that I wouldn't take back that pain and that anguish for anything, because it's helped form who I am. And it's helped me appreciate the joyous moments of life, of which there are many.
Tim Gunn, it has just been wonderful to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Terry. It's been a joy talking to you, and I thank you for your very thoughtful questions.
Tim Gunn's new fashion competition reality series, Project Runway Under the Gun, is on Lifetime. Coming up, Maureen Carrigan reviews two entertaining novels that may help you escape the winter gloom. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Snow, rain, ice, and general gloom getting you down? Our book critic Maureen Carrigan recommends two novels, one new, one just published here in the U.S., that she says are fine literary antidotes to the winter blues.
In the opening paragraph of Moby Dick, Ishmael tells us he takes to sea whenever he feels the onset of a damp, drizzly November in his soul. I know how he feels. Whenever the frigid funk of February settles in, I too yearn to get out of town. This year I have, thanks to two exquisite vehicles of escape fiction. Rachel Paston's Elena and Catherine Pankhold's The Yellow Eyes of Crocodiles are both smart entertainments, perfect for curling up with on a winter's night. Admittedly, they both fall into that much-disputed category of women's fiction. But I urge male readers not to feel automatically excluded, much as we women readers have learned to gamely step aboard boys-only clubs like that of, say, the Pequod. Speaking of Moby Dick and opening passages, Daphne du Maurier's 1938 novel Rebecca is a near rival to Melville's masterpiece when it comes to the fame of its first line. Last night I dreamt I went to Manderley again. You'll hear an echo of that line at the beginning of Rachel Paston's Elena, because Elena is an inspired reworking of du Maurier's Rebecca, which itself was an inspired reworking of Jane Eyre. As in Rebecca, our narrator here is unnamed, a sign of how little sense of self she possesses. Paston's narrator, who describes herself as a moth, works as a curator's assistant at a Midwestern art museum. Accompanying her odious boss to an art festival in Venice, she meets a tormented but charismatic gay man named Bernard Augustin, who's the founder of a renowned contemporary art museum on Cape Cod called the Nauk. Faster than you can say Maxim de Winter, the gloomy Bernard and our naive narrator bond platonically over cappuccinos, and he invites her to become the Nauk's new curator. That position is vacant because the former curator, a sleek, celebrated beauty named Elena, mysteriously vanished one night 2 years earlier into the dark waters off Cape Cod. Paston's Elena is so eerie and elegantly suspenseful that I could see myself rereading it the way I reread Rebecca every few years or so. One of Elena's distinctive pleasures is its deep familiarity with the contemporary art world, real and imagined. We hear, for instance, about extreme art exhibits where enormous collages of cotton and bone hang from the ceiling and dead sardines are nailed to gallery walls in great glittering waves of decay. The Nauk Museum itself is a brilliant riff on the Gothic mansions of yore. A modernist glass structure built into sand dunes, it conceals a labyrinth of cobwebby secrets and one vengeful female ghost bent on evicting our clueless narrator. The recently deceased Hollywood star Joan Fontaine played the mousy heroine in Hitchcock's film of Rebecca. I could see a modern-day Joan Fontaine type playing the heroine of The Yellow Eyes of Crocodiles, should a film version ever be made. Catherine Pankhold's novel was an immediate bestseller when it was published some years ago in Europe, and it's easy to see why. This is a delicious French romp, replete with affairs and wit and screwball plot twists. The story centers on a shy scholar of the Middle Ages named Josephine, whose husband has deserted her and their two daughters in order to run off to Kenya with his sexy mistress, where he's managing a crocodile farm that supplies illegal skins to China. In order to make ends meet back in Paris, Josephine agrees to a scheme hatched by her wealthy but bored older sister. She, Josephine, will ghostwrite a medieval romance novel, while her glamorous sister will do the promotion and get the credit. Of course, the novel becomes a blockbuster. Ethical dilemmas ensue, more marriages fall apart, and more affairs are sparked. The delicious draw of The Yellow Eyes of Crocodiles is Josephine's transformation from field mouse to falcon. Not only does she eventually stand up to her domineering sister, but more dramatically, to her contemptuous teenage daughter, a girl, Josephine realizes, who has no use for love, tenderness, or generosity, who faces life with a knife between her teeth. Though they're very different in tone, both Elena and the Yellow Eyes of Crocodiles are escape fantasies about shy, bookwormy types triumphing over glossy power divas. I don't know about you, but that's a fantasy that pretty much always works for me.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Elena by Rachel Paston and The Yellow Eyes of Crocodiles by Catherine Pancol. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a preview of an album coming out next week by a singer who's very popular in the Fresh Air office, Catherine Russell. The album's called Bring It Back, and it features songs that her father, the late Louis Russell, worked on with Louis Armstrong. He was Armstrong's music director. This song is I'm Shootin' High.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Angie's List, providing reviews of local roofers, painters, landscapers, and plumbers to keep the consumer informed. More at angieslist.com. From the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, helping people build measurably better lives. On the web at hewlett.org. And from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their innovations to solve the world's most pressing problems at skoll.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, the battle over internet neutrality. A recent court decision says the FCC cannot require internet service providers, such as cable companies, to treat all websites and content providers equally. ISPs can offer faster service and special deals to those they choose. We'll speak with law professor and telecommunications policy analyst Susan Crawford. Join us.